Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. I'm Tim Wyatt. We're sorry it's been a while since our last episode, but we have an exciting one for you today which we're sure you will enjoy. Last week, John's new book, The Robot Will See You Now, was published. It's a multi-author volume he has co-edited with the theologian Stephen Williams. They've gathered an array of other theologians, academics, thinkers and writers to explore how upcoming advances in robotics and artificial intelligence will revolutionise society, affecting everything from healthcare to employment, art to sex. And, perhaps more critically, they've been writing about how we as Christians can engage with and respond to these developments in cutting-edge and often unsettling technology. In today's episode, we're really pleased to be inviting on our first ever guest, Nathan Maladin, to Matters of Life and Death. Nathan is a researcher with the religion think tank Theos, and has also written a chapter for The Robot Will See You Now. With his insight, we're going to spend the next 45 minutes or so exploring the world of robotics and AI in general, but in particular looking at his focus in the book, which is surveillance capitalism. It's a fascinating discussion on an often overlooked topic, so let's get into it. Well, hello. Welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. Welcome, as always, to John. Thanks for joining us. But a particular welcome for the first time ever on the podcast. We've got a guest, Nathan Maladin. Nathan, do you want to quickly introduce yourself before I talk about what we're going to be discussing today?
Yes. Thanks very much for having me. I'm a senior researcher at Theos, the Christian think tank. I'm originally from Romania, and I've been living in London with my wife for the past 8 years, and in the last 3-4 years I've been quite interested in looking at ethics of technology and specifically AI, and I guess that's the main reason I'm on this podcast at this point.
That's exactly right. It's a little bit of a clue from Nathan. Today was really exciting because John is just published today, this very day, 15th of July, as we record, his latest book, which is a co-edited book with Stephen Williams. It's called The Robot Will See You Now. John, do you want to explain what the book is about and where the whole idea came from in the first place?
Yeah, so it's a fantastic experience when you actually get the physical copy, because I've had the onerous job of working on this book for several years. It's actually the first multi-author book that I've edited, and I didn't really quite realise how much work was involved in being an editor. But at long last, we now have, it's being published today by SBCK. I've been co-editing it with my friend Stephen Williams, and it's the outcome of a research project which I initially started back 2015 at the Faraday Institute in Cambridge, when I was leading a research project called Being Human in an Age of Nearly Human Machines. And I've been fascinated about the whole question of artificial intelligence and its implications for what it means to be human for a number of years. And so as part of this project, the idea was to have a number of workshops and interviews with a whole range of people, but particularly with theologians, philosophers, and people coming from a Christian professionals, technology professionals, in order to try and think about some of the some of the fundamental issues. And this book is really a product of that. Most of the people who are authors actually came to some of the workshops, including Nathan, and they've all been beavering away, writing different chapters. And yeah, and so I'm really quite nervous, but excited to see what the response will be to this new book.
And why this topic in particular? You said it's something you've been thinking about for a long time. Some people might be thinking, what on earth has Christianity, the church, ethics got to do with some obscure kind of tech research, mostly based on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, I've been interested in medical ethics, and a lot of that came out of my practical experience working as a paediatrician and a neonatologist. And the way that as technology advances, it raises new and challenging ethical questions. And one of the fundamental ideas, I think, is that as technology advances, it keeps asking afresh the question of what it means to be human. And that was something that came out time and time again from the kind of bioethics, the biotechnology world. And increasingly, I thought that this question of what it means to be human in the face of technology, that AI was the next challenge that was coming down the line, that as AI advanced, again, it would be raising this age-old question, what does it mean to be human? And so that's the reason I've been watching this field and fascinated by it. And that's really been the focus of this book. What does it mean to be human when we're in a world which is surrounded by intelligent machines?
And Nathan, what about you? How did you first get interested in researching this particular field, this intersection of technology, robotics, artificial intelligence, and Christianity?
Well, yeah, my background's in theology, systematic theology, but I've always been very curious about all sorts of issues, particularly how to think Christianly about pressing issues in the wider culture, how to bridge kind of the world of the church and theological reflection and big ideas and developments in the culture. So through my work at Theos, I began to see lots of articles about various new developments in robotics and didn't really see a lot of ethical reflection, asking kind of the deeper questions about the meaning of these developments for human relationships, for the wider society. So I just became more and more interested to get at these more fundamental, deeper philosophical questions. And I guess just naturally began to apply my Christian mind to these questions. Had the opportunity to work on a project looking at the big tech sector as a whole and scrutinize it ethically and see what kinds of opportunities investors have to shape the behaviors of these big corporations in light of growing awareness of the impacts of the ramifications of particularly social media, but increasingly just a wider network of corporations using data. So I had the opportunity to work on that. Then John and Stephen kindly pulled me into this project, which sits behind the book that is coming out today, and just carried on working on these issues. And we're hoping to do even more work within Theos on the many topics that actually come under AI, and really trying to reflect Christianly in a robust and informed way on these specific developments and on their ramifications for the way we see ourselves, for the way we relate to one another, for the shape of our politics, and so on. Mm.
And it this sounds really interesting, these workshops where you're pulling in theologians and computer scientists and academics and thinkers and writers. Were there kind of common themes that came out when you were getting these kind of big brains to get around a table and talk about their own theological reflections on AI and robotics?
I mean, what was interesting to me was initially it was quite hard work to get to find theologians who were prepared to engage seriously with these topics, which quite surprised me in a way. But I rapidly came to the conclusion that actually it was very unfashionable. Certainly when we started the project, it was very unfashionable for theologians to engage with these kind of issues. You know, it's interesting how there are fashions in all things, and there are fashions in theology and applied theology. And paradoxically, there was quite a lot of work going on about transhumanism, about human enhancement. There was even work going on about alien civilizations and alien intelligences, but virtually no serious theological reflection about artificial intelligence. And I was quite puzzled why that was, but I'm still slightly puzzled. But I was very grateful when Stephen Williams, who's very well-established systematic theologian, and Robert Song, professor of theology in Durham, both of whom friends of mine, agreed to be part of the project, and therefore they gave it a kind of theological heavyweight aspect, which I was very grateful for.
It's fascinating when I'm just looking down the kind of chapter headings of the book. It spans an enormous range of ideas from, you know, science fiction and medicine, humanity, sex bots, the future of work and employment, health and social care, artistic creation, surveillance capitalism. It's enormous. It almost touches every area of society. Did you see any kind of main themes emerging when you were editing the book together and trying to draw some of these, all these different authors' chapters into a kind of coherent whole? Were there common threads that you were able to pull together?
Yes, there were, but you're right. I mean, the very enormous range itself is both fascinating and challenging, but also it's part of the problem about trying to identify common themes. Certainly, you know, as I had expected, one of the common themes is about what it means to be human. And related to that is the particular Christian understanding of the image of God. You know, in Latin, the Imago Dei. It's Orthodox Christianity has always seen that as being a fundamental part of our understanding about what it means to be human. But then the different, you know, the subtly different understandings of what that means, interestingly, lead to different responses to artificial intelligence. So that was one of the themes that came out. Another theme which I have always been fascinated by, and which did come up a number of times, and that is this whole thing about simulation. You know, how and the fact that theologically there's been very little reflection about how we think about a simulated human. And yet that does seem to me a really important theme, which did come out several times.
And when you dwelling in particular on that question of kind of humanity and personhood, which does seem to be this repeated theme, did the authors, does the book come to a conclusion about how we should think about kind of like quasi-human artificial kind of intelligences? You know, this is obviously comes up in film and in fiction all the time. You know, in a future world where humans can create machines or software which can perfectly mimic humanness, what is it, how do we distinctive, is there a simple answer to that question of what Christians should do about this question of humanity and personhood? And
well, surprise, surprise, the short answer is no, there isn't a simple response. But I think there are, I mean, I think all the authors of the book are aware and concerned about potential threats of, you know, of artificial intelligence being viewed as a sort of competitors to humankind. So I think all the authors would be concerned and critical, But again, there's a sort of interesting distinctions, which in some senses is revealed by these two heavyweight theologians, Stephen Williams on the one hand, Robert Song on the other, in that Stephen Williams would, to very much simplify his position, but he would basically, I think, and is arguing that there is something so-called essentialist about the way that human beings are created, which no machine can ever challenge, and therefore it's simply not possible for a machine to be like a human being, simply because of the way that human beings are created and the way that machines are constructed. Then they're fundamentally different in their nature. Robert Song tends to take a different view, which says that the image of God is more to do with how we are, what we are called, our calling to be, and therefore that we shouldn't be threatened by as machines become more and more capable. I mean, it's a bit like his response would say that we shouldn't have like a kind of God of the gaps theology, which emphasizes all the different things about human beings, so that every time machines develop some new ability, we shouldn't say, oh, this is threatening me as a human being. What we should see is that human beings have a unique calling, a unique vocation given by God. So it's not so much, it doesn't come from the essential way in which you're created, it comes from the fact of our unique calling that's been given to us. So I think that is an important and interesting debate, and it obviously has implications, because I think that someone who takes the theological position that Robert Song takes would be less hostile to the idea that we might expect machines to take on more of what traditionally human beings have done.
It sounds really interesting, kind of two ends of the spectrum or two approaches to this question. I know, Nathan, it's not the thrust of your contribution to The Robot Will See You Now, but I wondered if you had a view on, or do you follow Williams or Song on that line in particular?
Yeah, I was thinking while John was kind of synthesizing those two approaches, whether they are that different, in fact, if you look close enough. The way I know Stephen would put it, and I would align myself with that, is that we are, yes, essentially, fundamentally related at the level of our very being to God. We are fundamentally in relationship to God. And when I say we, I mean every human being. So in a sense, I think he's making a fundamental philosophical point that whatever new capabilities machines develop, they can't threaten the human uniqueness if we define it in this essential relatedness to God. I think what is interesting is to see, okay, so what does that then lead you in terms of how you respond to practical developments and to robots becoming smarter and smarter and threatening to take our jobs and to alter the way we relate to one another? And I think Robert and Stephen would probably be similarly concerned about some of these developments, even if fundamentally and philosophically human uniqueness is threatened. But I do wonder if Robert's position, which highlights calling, doesn't lead to a kind of a functionalist understanding of the image of God, which basically says, well, we have a particular function as human beings in God's creation, and that's what distinguishes us from other creatures. And if it does, if this is how we parse it out, then robots could potentially do those functions in some ways even better than we would. So at that point, I think you'd have to again reassess, okay, so what makes us unique? But for me, I think fundamentally this is how I would say. We are, just by virtue of being born into the world, we are already inescapably in relation to God. And therefore, our creations, what we make, what robots kind of can be, can we can conjure up, cannot be in fundamental relationship with God, because they are our creations, and what we create cannot be fundamentally related to us. They are distinct from us. Whereas I think, you know, because God is, Christians would say, and not just Christians, in fact, the ground of being, the source of all being, there's therefore a fundamental distinction between we as human beings and whatever we create, however intelligent and capable those creations are. And I guess this would be a good opportunity to talk about intelligence and how we define that. That's very interesting to me.
Mm. So to kind of try and sum up, if I'm hearing you right, it seems like you're suggesting that even if in a future world we were able to construct machines which were like functionally identical internally and externally, they thought like us, they felt like us, they were better than us at everything that we do as humans, because they're not made in the image of God and they cannot be in relationship with him in the same way that we can, our humanness is unthreatened, and our uniqueness above all the rest of created order is unthreatened.
Yes, but again, this is a fairly subtle, but I think important point. But this shouldn't make us complacent. I mean, I don't think we should simply then, okay, because this is the case, if we believe this is the case, therefore we should just sit back and relax and let the tech giants, because they're the ones driving this innovation, let them develop these robots and these powerful systems. I think there are other concerns, and I think John's already mentioned them, simulation and therefore increasing capacity for deception and for kind of dispersed deception, not simply like me wanting to deceive you, but just us completely losing grasp of what is real, what is the truth of any given matter. So I think there are all sorts of concerns that everyone should have, and Christians should have in particular, given the story they inhabit, the gospel of the kingdom. So what I'm saying is, whatever we decide on how we conceive of the image of God in a abstract philosophical point of view, that shouldn't make us complacent as to the concrete challenges that are kind of coming down the tracks, which raise profound ethical questions which should be answered carefully.
Well, let's move from philosophy to ethics then, John. Could you spell out maybe a handful of particular issues that come out in the book that you think Christians need to be thinking about, maybe concerned about, rather than these kind of abstruse ideas about human uniqueness and the image of God?
Yes, and I think certainly the book highlights a number of real concerns. I mean, employment and the implications of artificial intelligence systems increasingly taking over the jobs which previously human beings have undergone. I think that is a very real ethical issue. And what's very interesting is that whereas in previous industrial revolutions it was the sort of the muscle jobs, the jobs that were involved a great deal of physical labour, and that were dirty and repetitive and so on, those very physical jobs which machinery tended to be able to take over, now increasingly what's happening is that it's cognitive jobs that require human intelligence that are under threat, and that includes many jobs which previously could be done by professionals of one kind or another. And so I think the whole question of employment and the implications of people losing jobs and being replaced by technology, that's certainly one. There's a whole chapter about sex robots and sex technology and the way the implications that that's having on on human relationships. I wrote a chapter about healthcare and the way the implications for replacing human carers, human physicians, and so on with automated smartphone-based apps, for instance, for mental health care, for caring for elderly people, and so on. Some fascinating work which Andrei Tkachuk did on questions of whether artificial intelligence could be genuinely creative. And there are increasingly now artificial intelligence systems which can generate music, can write poems, can paint pictures, and so on. And so the question is how we think about these systems and the implications for human creativity. So an extraordinarily wide range of issues.
Hmm. It's interesting that last point you raised, because I think people, certainly people I'm kind of engaging and talking about this with, often feel like, you know, yes, the AI is coming for jobs that can be kind of white collar jobs in offices on computers that can be automated away. But it's the artists and the creatives who are probably most safe from that, because, you know, they're doing something that can't be converted into ones and zeros very easily. But you seem to suggest that actually even those kind of what we think of as grey human, very individualistic, very personal roles might also succumb to the AI apocalypse.
Well, certainly, I mean, there's a commercial interest in this because human artists are extremely expensive and often unreliable. And so just from a sheer sort of capitalist, you know, this enormous emphasis on efficiency, on speed of production, on reliability, all of these things drive towards machinery, which is consistent. And so if a machine, for instance, if we want a soundtrack to a television drama serial, instead of asking a human being to sit at a computer and generate some new music, you know, could an artificial intelligence just look at all the previous music that's been produced for a similar scene and come up with an original background, in which case there are obvious commercial advantages.
Nathan, we're going to come on to talk in particular about your chapter in the book about surveillance capitalism in a moment. But before we do, I wanted to ask, was there any other particular area when you were looking at what the other authors have written that really jumped out at you? Maybe something we haven't mentioned that you think is something that Christians really need to start thinking about sooner rather than later in this area?
Well, my concern, and I think it does come through in some of the chapters, and I definitely mention it, and it's a component of my chapter, is really our increasing reliance on algorithms and algorithmic decision-making processes and tools. And I think this is a part of AI that we don't speak enough about, and people don't readily imagine this is AI, but it is AI. And in fact, that's the way I kind of begin my chapter, or our chapter rather. There's all sorts of AI available, embedded in our devices, in the phones, in the Alexa from Amazon, and all sorts of spaces and products that rely on algorithmic processes, which are basically these, you know, sophisticated tools for churning through lots of data and lots of data points, and they're used by all sorts of institutions to make decisions. So in fact, this is actually one of the big components of surveillance capitalism, and I'm sorry for kind of jumping into that, but I think reliance on algorithmic processes is an area that I think you know, needs much more attention and some very, very strong, robust responses.
We're all familiar, I think, with the idea that algorithms determine, you know, what video comes up next on YouTube, or what we see on our Facebook wall. But how can you explain a few ways and how they're present in maybe more subtle ways that we're not familiar with and in services that we might use on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, they're present in determining insurance premiums, in determining educational outcomes and grades. They're used, in fact, I was just reading an article preparing for this conversation about Amazon using, basically completely automating their HR department for their Flex service, which delivers Amazon, not Prime, but Now, which obviously ballooned during the pandemic with lots of people just, with everyone basically more or less locked in their homes. So the algorithm assesses the CVs that people upload through a portal. It scores the drivers, it fires the drivers. So there's no human present in this loop. So the human resources are now without humans basically to manage what I think are improperly called resources. So I think, you know, that is an example of Amazon and other companies doing this, relying on these very sophisticated tools to automate processes, again, in the drive for efficiency, for convenience, for maximizing return on investment, et cetera, et cetera. So that is, you know, something I'd throw out there. Mm.
Leads us quite nicely on to surveillance capitalism, which is the topic of your and Stephen Williams' chapter in The Robot Will See You Now. Before we discuss the kind of main thrust of the argument and the discussion that you make, could you give us a quick definition of the phrase surveillance capitalism and tell us where it came from?
Yeah, well, it's generally associated with a book, a significant book that's come out 2-3 years ago by a Harvard professor called Shoshana Zuboff, and it's called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Now, it's likely that the phrase was used before, but I think she is now the person most commonly associated with surveillance capitalism. So what is surveillance capitalism? Well, I kind of dread the thought of trying to define it very briefly, but, well, the clue's in the name, really. You've got capitalism, especially kind of the kind of capitalism, the kind of market economy and the kinds of objectives pursued, which is maximizing shareholder profit. And then you've got surveillance, which is really to do with the capabilities provided now by digital technology and other forms of technology to track, to harvest data from devices, from surfaces, from what we post online, from our movements, and to aggregate all of these data points into vast data sets, which are then analyze with the use of powerful AIs, powerful tools, chief among them being sort of machine learning and deep learning, which I won't go into the details of. But basically, it's about creating very sophisticated models and predictions of human behavior. So the system is basically monetizing this data that particularly social media companies, but increasingly other companies are harvesting. So you have this vast network of data brokers, which just cart data from place to place and sell it to various people, primarily to advertisers, which target you in a very, very pointed way based on the inferences that have been made and predictions of what you might want to purchase or what you might want to see next. So it's basically an entire system built around personalized, targeted advertising. It's not just social media. It's extending, as I said, to other sectors. And the fundamental problem is that it's fundamentally opaque. You really don't know what information is being collected, what information is being derived from that about you. And it creates all sorts of problems.
And I sense from the way you talk about it and that you're potentially quite critical of surveillance capitalism. Could you explain why you think Christians should be concerned about the rise of this form of technology and how it's kind of pervading the internet, our devices, and the cloud and everything else?
Well, the way I think about it is actually in terms of power, right? Power is an ambivalent, complicated notion, but at the end of the day, what we have in a surveillance system, in a surveillance economy, is very few people, very powerful corporations, a handful of them, that have enormous power. And as Christians who read our Old Testament and our New Testament, you look at the Old Testament, you have so many checks and balances, so many laws and regulations to protect against this concentration of power into the hands of the few. So I think this is the fundamental problem with the current kind of surveillance capitalist system. You have so much power accruing to so few people. So therefore, this raises huge questions for democracy, for human relationships, because it perpetuates all sorts of inequalities and harms to already disadvantaged, vulnerable groups. So they're unaccountable, largely, although obviously governments are kind of picking up and on the fact that these powers need some accountability, and they're clamping down in some respects. So, yes, power has to be interrogated, scrutinized, and better ways of governing our world, where data plays such an important part, have to be found.
John, do you share Nathan's concerns?
Yeah, I do. I think, and I very strongly recommend Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. It's a big doorstopper of a book and quite heavy going in some ways, but it's absolutely an extraordinary work of investigative journalism, really, of working out precisely what these massive companies, Google, Facebook, Microsoft and so on, were up to and how their business model worked. And it's really very chilling. And there's another aspect which, in addition to what Nathan has said, which I thoroughly agree with, and that is that these companies have worked out techniques of behavior modification. In other words, they're not just monitoring us. They're actually changing our behavior, modifying our behavior in order to maximize their profits. But they're doing this in an incredibly sophisticated and covert way so that we're not aware of it. And their aim is to make us addicted to the technology, make us addicted to their websites, make us addicted to clicking certain buttons, because that will maximize their profits. And you only have to look at how successful that's been. For instance, in making people addicted to smartphones, making them addicted to particular websites, social media, whatever it is. And this has not an accident. It's not an accident that the smartphone has become utterly irreplaceable in our lives. This is part of a very sophisticated campaign at using the hidden means of behavior modification.
It's a fascinating point, that one, because I was just reading the other day, maybe a day or two ago, an article from the States, maybe in the Washington Post, which was talking about the role that Facebook has in kind of boosting a lot of the very kind of dangerous far right wing kind of populist pro-Trump insurrectionist kind of content which flourishes there. And that actually after the election in November last year, the American presidential election, Facebook actually kind of dialed down some of the virality and the other kind of things to just prevent some of this content from spreading, because they were worried that, you know, there was literally going to burst out into violence, as it sadly did, as we know, in the Capitol. But they've since kind of returned to it, which is concerning in itself. But what is amazing to me is that, you know, executives at Facebook, this single unaccountable company, actually have the power by changing various parts of the algorithms that run Facebook's recommendations and groups and sharing and all that kind of stuff. They can actually make people angrier or less angry, you know, more misinformed or more informed. They can boost truthful sources of information, or they can boost kind of angry populist ranting. And that's just a remarkable ability for any private firm to have over, you know, something like a third of the world's population now live on Facebook.
Yeah, and it's based on a whole discipline, a sort of secret discipline. I mean, it's not secret. There are, but if you do are prepared to trawl around, you can find it. But it's basically called social physics, and the idea has been to work out the laws which govern human relationships, very much like the laws which govern physics, you know. And then once you work those out, of course, the idea is now we've got hold of the levers. Now, using our technology, we can manipulate people, manipulate relationships. And I mean, in the West, all this technology is orientated towards capitalism, towards maximizing shareholder value, as Nathan says. Of course, very, very similar technology is available to totalitarian governments, particularly China, but other totalitarian governments. And they're using it not to maximize their profits, but to obtain social control. But in the same way, they've got their hands on the levers and they can control millions and millions of their population.
And Nathan, do you draw any kind of conclusions in your chapter about what we as Christians should do about this? I mean, should we all be opting out of big tech's products? Should we be deleting our Facebook accounts, junking our iPhones? Or is there some kind of middle ground form of civil disobedience we can do while retaining a foot in this modern techno-capitalist world that we all live in?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because, you know, we're all kind of implicated. And as John and you were saying, we're not talking about kind of a discrete place or activity, you know. Okay, we pick up the phone and now we're dealing with surveillance capitalism, and then we put the phone down. And so it's kind of hard to completely check out. And I think that would be, in some way, irresponsible. We have to be present as Christians, but we have to set boundaries. We have to be aware of harms, even subtle harms, and we should protect our privacy. Actually, I think, to go back to what John was saying earlier, I do agree. I think Christians have been late, and are risk being late again at this, you know, conversation about the ethics of AI. And we're hoping that the book will, in fact, catalyze a conversation. But in fact, there's a lot of really good work being done by all sorts of AI ethics groups and privacy advocacy groups. And they keep coming back to, you know, how do we protect our privacy? And I think we should be more concerned about our privacy, and should learn, you know, what is being done with our data. And therefore, yes, use browsers and devices that are more privacy secure. I think that's something we should do. I think we should use better browsers, not use Google, and other kind of alternatives to the tech giants. I think that's really hard, because obviously there's so many people who are on these platforms, and we'd have to make some sacrifices. But, you know, some sacrifices are, I think, necessary. So I think, yeah, just to summarize, not completely checking out, but setting boundaries, really living out our convictions about how we are We should be looking out for the most vulnerable among us, and we shall always be concerned not primarily about convenience and maximizing easiness, but really looking at the effects on the least and the lost and the
Well, I'd certainly agree with that. You know, that we must be most concerned for those who are vulnerable, and I think another approach which I'm very keen to try and promote is what's often called harm minimization. And this is an approach which doctors, for instance, have pioneered for many years to do with drug addicts. You know, obviously the best thing for a drug addict is to get them off their heroin completely. But we've also recognized that just taking steps to minimize the harm being done to an addict is in itself valuable. And so things like giving clean needles and syringes and offering methadone, oral methadone rather than heroin, it has some value. And in the same way, it might be the ideal thing that we all lose our addiction to technology. But in reality, that's not going to happen. What we can do is try and minimize the harm. And so, for instance, I think that, you know, if we remember there was a whole lot of concern about fixed odds betting terminals, which were where people could bet huge sums of money and win huge sums of money and just got trapped into this addictive behavior. And in many ways, you know, the smartphone and social media sites are very similar to a fixed odds betting terminal. And one of the approaches the government took was to reduce the reward that you could get the maximum sum from £100 to £2, which dramatically reduced the addictive potential. And the question would be, is there a similar kind of approach that the government could enforce in order to reduce the addictive potential of these sites and of this technology?
I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that particular question, Nathan?
It's complex. I agree in principle because, you know, we can't fabricate a paradise, and I guess in a sense a Christian view of the end times, eschatology, is actually helpful because it gives you just that kind of tension between not trying to achieve perfection here while also not being, again, complacent. And harms minimization is a good principle to follow when you realize, yeah, you can't, bring new creation through policy and regulation, but you can actually make the system better, safer, fairer, move towards democratic governance of such data rather than these massive monopolies that have been created. I'm in principle, I'm in agreement with that.
And just lastly then, before we wrap up, I wanted to talk briefly about what the kind of wider church does with this information, not just about surveillance capitalism, but about this whole topic of AI and robotics in general. I know you both are very passionate and you've kind of explained why you think this is a really critical issue. I'm totally persuaded. But if you were just an ordinary lay Christian or a church leader, what do we do with this? Is this something that we should be preaching about? Should people be hearing about this in the pew? Should we be doing it Bible studies? Or is this going to be ultimately left to kind of ethicists, computer scientists, experts like yourselves?
Well, I mean, if I can jump in there, I think, sadly, this is where the leadership of the church, both at a local level and to be honest, at a national level, is way behind where many of the flock are. I mean, you know, I know that many ordinary Christians are concerned about these issues because they see it every day. They're aware of it. They see their children engaging with this technology. You know, they worry about the Alexa that they keep talking to and the hold it seems to have over the family. And so they're keen to discuss these issues. I think, sadly, for whatever reason, most of the church leadership just doesn't see it as important. One of the things we've talked about before is this seeming obsession that so much of the church leadership has at the moment about sex. You know, that as though sexual issues, you know, dealing with questions about same-sex attraction, about gender in church, about transgender issues, about sexual promiscuity, as though these are really the only or the major ethical issues of our time. And I think, yes, of course these issues are important, but I think they shouldn't be allowed to displace some of these other issues, which actually are far more pervasive and potentially extremely damaging. So I do hope and pray that these issues will rise up the agenda. Of course, I sympathise with preachers and church leaders who must feel there's a tsunami of issues coming at them. You know, and how on earth can they be an expert on all these things? And of course, the answer is they can't be an expert and they shouldn't try to be an expert. What they should be doing is looking for people within the Christian congregations, within the Christian world, who do have some expertise in this issue, because, you know, God has his people in all these different spheres, and we should be using them in order to try and understand the times we live in and learn how to respond.
And just finally then, Nathan, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic when you consider the future of how this conversation is going in the church? Do you think that there are people kind of waking up to these concerns that you've been thinking about, researching, raising? Or do you think we've got a way to go before AI is anywhere near kind of top of people's agenda?
I am hopeful, which I think is better than optimistic or pessimistic. I'm hopeful that this book and other key Christian leaders that I am aware of are able to find people around them and congregations and church networks that can engage with these issues. I don't think it's too late, and I think if we manage to show that this is something that ordinary people bump into or participate, whether they're aware of it or not, and show the importance of engaging with these things, I think that we have a chance to not just sleepwalk into another major revolution without having the proper response.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I think that's all the time we've got for today. Thanks so much to Nathan and to John, as always, for taking part. It's been a really fascinating conversation, and I hope it was interesting to those of you listening at home. We'll be back as soon as we can with another episode of Matters of Life and Death. But it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from them as too. Thanks for listening to this episode of Matters of Life and Death. We hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to find out more about John and Nathan's book, The Robot Will See You Now, including where you can pre-order it in either paperback or as an ebook, please click on the link in the podcast notes for this episode. I'd also like to personally apologise for changing the music for the last episode of the podcast. Your feedback has been heard and received. The old music is back, and I definitely won't be fiddling with it again, I promise. Thank you also to everyone who filled in the short listener survey as well. Your feedback is really helpful in ensuring Matters of Life and Death is as useful to you all as it can be. As always, any other questions, suggestions or comments can be sent to mattersoflifeanddeathpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.